Okay, lesson 9. We actually have quite a bit to cover tonight. We're going to try to cover 4 different topics: host desecration, Black Death or Black Plague, the end of the Spanish Golden Age, and the Spanish Inquisition. So I will not take any questions. No, just kidding. You can stop me anytime you want. Okay, host desecration. Now, last week we talked about in the last couple of weeks about the blood libel, when Jewish people were accused of taking the blood of Christians and killing little babies, and making matzah, which of course was a big lie. It's a nonsense according to Jewish law. But now a new accusation is coming to the surface, and that accusation actually lasted 400 years. In 1215, which was the Fourth Lateran Council, Pope Innocent III finally recognized the Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation and made it an official part of the Catholic Church. From that point on, whenever a Christian, or Catholic, I should say, but back then, you know, there was really no difference in the terminology, would partake of the Lord's Supper, it was believed that the chalice of wine, that the wine inside the chalice would become, at that time, the very blood of Jesus. And that the wafer, or the host, of pretty much unleavened bread, although they were not matzah, but they would make those wafers, would become the very body of the Messiah, the blood and the body of Jesus. There's, of course, no biblical foundation for the doctrine of transubstantiation. It's hard, you can debate that until you're blue in the face with Catholic people. They strongly believe that they eat the body of Jesus and they drink the blood of Jesus, which makes them cannibals every time they take communion, but that's a different story. Yeshua spoke of his body and his blood as he was closing the Passover Seder in the upper room and linking what he was about to do for the world, Jews and Gentiles alike, to the third cup of the Passover Seder, the cup of redemption, and to the unleavened broken matzah of the Passover, not remembering that leaven in the Passover is always accompanied. Leaven in the Bible, anytime leaven is used symbolically, it's always to represent sin. Leaven is sin, unleavened is without sin. So it's interesting that the bread that he used to symbolize his body was a pierced, striped piece of unleavened bread that he broke and he hid, and it's a great symbolism in the Passover. But right there, this is what Yeshua did. He talked about the symbolism behind it, not that it became his body. As a matter of fact, it's even ludicrous to think that he would even have it become his body when he was still alive talking about it. Let alone when he was dead, that it would reproduce and become his body. But when he was still alive, he would say, "This is my body, this is my blood." This doesn't make any sense. Luke 22, 14 through 20. "And when the hour had come, he reclined at a table, and the apostles with him. And he said to them, 'I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I said to you, I shall never again eat until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God.' And when he had taken a cup and given thanks, he said, 'Take this and share it among yourselves. For I said to you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine from now on until the kingdom of God comes.' And when he had taken some bread and given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, 'This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' And in the same way, he took the cup after they had eaten, saying, 'This cup which is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood.'" This misinterpretation of this passage in the book of Luke and in other passages in the scripture about the blood and the body of Jesus is what led to the doctrine of transubstantiation, and then believing that the host, the piece of bread that they use in the Catholic Church became the body of Jesus. Now, 1243 marks the beginning of the accusations of host desecration in Belitz, Germany, near Berlin, where as a result, all the Jews of the town were killed. More accusations prevailed throughout all of Europe and France, and from France to Poland and from Prague to Berlin for centuries to follow. As a result, Jews were burned at the stake, and the last Jewish people dying because of the host desecration accusation were in 1613. You're looking at almost, 350 years or so of massacres of Jewish people being accused of host desecration. Now, the way Christians explained it is that the reason given by Christians was that the Jews would desecrate communion wafers piercing them, and the blood of Yeshua would start pouring, and that they were able to reenact the crucifixion for which they were originally guilty. So they wanted to, you know, mock Christianity, and they would take the communion wafers and pierce them, and sometimes the blood would come out, and they would recreate the crucifixion, reenact the crucifixion, and mock Christianity, and do that in pure hatred of Christians. So, of course, there's no truth to it, no foundation, but this was bought by a lot of people. And, of course, the original guilt of the Jewish people killing the Messiah is also achieved by completely ignoring the Bible that claimed that Yeshua himself gave his own life so that he could take it back. That if anybody was guilty of his death, it's all of us here in this room, anybody in the world. It's not just the Jews, the Romans, this guy, that group. It's everybody. And nobody. He took his own life, and we see in John 10, 14 through 18, I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me. Even as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, I lay down my life for the sheep. And I have other sheep which are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they shall hear my voice. And there shall become one flock with one shepherd. For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative, and I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it back, to take it up again. This commandment I received from my Father. This was the choice of God himself, that Yeshua would come and lay down his life for all of us. We all are guilty of his death because he died for all of our sins. The Jewish people are not guilty of the death of Messiah. But that, of course, didn't go that way when, in the Middle Ages, they were accused of host desecration. So on the next page, you have an illustration of Jewish people piercing holy bread in Stenberg, Germany. Host desecration accusation led many Europeans, especially Germans and Austrians, to go from community to community and slaughter Jewish people. As a result, about 100,000 Jews from over 140 different communities were massacred. And I think that's covering the time where From the time that it started to the end, which is about 350 years. But you look at it, a lot of Jewish people on one accusation only, host desecration. These massacres were the first historical attempt at holding European Jewry corporately responsible for a crime, a pattern that would repeat itself several times until it was used during World War II for the methodical attempt at eliminating all Jews of Europe through the Holocaust. This is the first time that the Jewish community is looked at by the Christians and the non-Christians, you know, the people of Europe, looking at the Jews and say, okay, they're responsible corporately. All of them are responsible. It's not even a crime of he did it, but he didn't. He's guilty, he's not. She's guilty, he's not. It becomes a corporate guilt syndrome where all Jews are not, it's at least an attempt at making it a corporate guilt, and it will be picked up later in a much stronger way, of course, during the Holocaust. In 1320, a defrocked Benedictine monk led about 40,000 shepherds into a European kind of a mini crusade against 120 Jewish communities. Soon after that, a new myth was born, introduced by the people of Europe. And of course, it was accepted as fact without any proof of anything. It was the poisoning of the wells of Europe. So we went from the host desecration is linked to it. We have the host desecration. They take the holy bread, they pierce it, and they destroy it. They reenact the crucifixion, and now we have the poisoning of the wells of Europe. Poisoning of the wells of Europe started in 1321, about 30 years prior to the Great Plague, and the Great Plague. The church was looking for a reason why the Great Plague, and of course, you know, not having the medical knowledge that we have today, the Great Plague was a tremendous loss. I mean, 75 million people died. We're going to talk about it in a minute, but we had to find who was behind it, and the people realized that, oh, We got the answer. The Jews poisoned the wells of Europe. So with people drinking the water, they got sick and they all died. So poisoning of the wells of Europe. In 1321, a rumor was spread that the king of Tunisia and some infidels and some lepers from the Jewish community had conspired together to put an end to Christianity. They were accused of preparing a poison made of urine, herbs, human blood, and of course, a sacred host. You know, it's like right in the midst of that. Those. Oh, they are there. But yes, but remember, the Jews are very connected because they control everything. So I'm sure they have a way to get a sacred host for a very good price too, because they're stingy and they don't pay. I mean, I'm making a joke here, but you're right. Where would they get it? Where would they get it? I don't know. I don't know. They would steal it. They would go to the church at night, probably, and I'm sure in the records of the church somewhere, in some obscure room in the Vatican somewhere, we have, you know, records of how they acquired the host, or buy it from a Christian for a lot of money. I don't know. They, you know, if they can come up with a story that they got the sacred host, I'm sure they can come up with an alibi or a story of how they actually got it. It was believed that they basically prepared, you know, this concoction with the poison, with urine, herbs, human blood, and sacred host to make it like anti-Christian, of course. It was several centuries before the birth of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, this book that is a known hoax about the trying to sell the whole world with the myth of the Jewish people conspiring to take over the entire planet. And this book is still being used today. I showed you some covers of it early in the class. When we started, a total of 5,000 Jews were killed. Confiscation of goods, fines were applied. Finally, Jews were expelled from France in 1322, only to be reallowed in 59 until Yom Kippur of 1394, the Day of Atonement, when a final edict was signed to expel all Jews once and for all, putting an end to 1,000 years of Jewish life in France. And by the mid-1300s, the combined efforts of the church and the state, as noble as they might have been, were powerless against the tidal waves of mob anger towards Jews in their communities. We have to admit, we have to, you know, when you look at the records, when you look at history, some popes, some bishops, some kings and emperors were actually not as bad as some others. Charlemagne in France in the 800s was a friend of the Jews. Pope Gregory, who was not the best, was also in some areas a friend of the Jews. They would either not add too many laws on top of what already was there, or they would be looking the other way when Jewish people broke some of the laws, or they would let Jewish people do things they were not supposed to. So some of these people were within the church and within the state were actually not really big enemies of the Jewish people, but they are losing ground, and the masses, the people, are not paying attention to the church and the state, and they are now just going after the Jewish people wherever they can find them. With the advent of the Black Death or Black Plague, the legend of poisoning the wells of Europe has finally found a fertile ground. You know, it kind of happened before the Black Plague, that this was a myth that kind of was born out of another way of another lie we can come up with against the Jewish people. And when you look at all this, it's easy to compare what's happening today in modern 21st century against Israel and the Jewish people. The world is being fed a bunch of lies about Israel and buying those lies, which makes Israel look really bad. That's what's happening with the liberals and with Islam. All those things that, like the little movie about Durban and everything, all those lies that are fed to the masses today about Israel and the Jewish people are different, but they're no different in the agenda behind them is no different that was back then. Get rid of the Jews, okay? The scapegoats of humanity. So here we have a poisoning of the wells of Europe, and all of a sudden, I'm sure one morning, some Christians got up and said, "Ah, I got it. They poisoned the wells of Europe. They've been doing this. They've been accused of doing this for 30 years. Now look, now we've got the black plagues because they poisoned the wells of Europe." So that was another reason why we should stop. You know, that why the Christians should stop the Jewish people from existing. So the Black Death or the Black Plague had given them a fertile ground to express their hatred and to justify their killing. was the most devastating pandemic in the history of mankind from 1347 to 1350. It was responsible for the death of 75 million people worldwide, 25 million in Europe alone. That's a lot of people. I think it was 25% of the planet.
It was fleas, not
flies. I misspelled it. It was fleas, not flies. So change the letter here. Yes. Exactly. It's fleas, not flies. Thank you. I did mention that today, but I did not fix the typo. I could have done that. It is believed that it was caused by a bacterium found on fleas, not flies. Thank you. Carried by black rats from Asia to ships to Europe, and it was the route that was known back then as the Silk Road. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so. It would take about 150 years for Europe's population to recover, while other minor plagues hit Europe until the 19th century. There was a bad one also in England. So it was at that time that the Black Plague or the Bubonic Plague of the mid-1300 was a major devastation. Only the First Crusade of 1096 and the Holocaust compared in intensity and devastation. I'm back to the devastation in the Jewish people. I mean, a lot of death took place, you know, by virtue of what the plague was doing to people. But a lot of Jewish people died. Some Jewish people died in the plague as well. I mean, they were not completely exempt. Of course, a lot of them died, but not as many. We're going to see this in a minute. It was 3 years of horrors for the Jewish communities of Europe. As the rest of the continent appeared to be on its way to total extinction, people started to look for a cause, and it was not long before the Jews were once again used as the convenient scapegoats of humanity. Revealed under extreme torture, the absurd recipe for the poison used by the Jews was apparently a little different from the one they used 30 years prior. They must have fine-tuned the recipe, I guess. It was now made of lizard, spiders, frogs, human hearts, and, of course, sacred host. They had a stash of sacred host that they'd gotten from somewhere. That's so stupid. There's an illustration there on the top of page 5 of Jews accused of poisoning the wells of Europe were burnt at the stake. And you see, if you remember last week, we talked about the Jewish garb, the round circle on their garment and the pointy hat. Well, you see one, two, three, at least three Jewish heads in that crowd with the pointy hat, two in the back and one in the front. That's the same Jewish hat. That's a representation of Jewish people being burnt for poisoning the wells of Europe. Change the date on that next line to 4750, not 5860. That's another typo. Jewish people also died during the Black Death of 1347-1350, but generally in lesser numbers. And that's what got the Christians to even get more upset. They go like, see, they're not even dying as many of us. A lot of them are not dying. What's going on? Well, the strict kosher laws that religious Jews are bound to follow force them to maintain a stricter hygiene and thus resulted in less death in the Jewish communities. It's that simple. I personally don't keep kosher. Oh, now it's official. But there's a lot of good advantages to keeping kosher and not eating some of the forbidden food that are biblically forbidden to Jewish people. Most Jewish people don't keep kosher, but back then, religious Jews, they were keeping kosher, and because of the strict regulation of kosher food and kosher regulation, it put them in a different... They had to be more careful and they had a stricter hygiene, and it resulted in less death from the Black Plague. Because back then, you didn't have refrigerators and Tupperware and Saran wrap or whatever. So it was definitely, there was a difference there, and that was the reason. But of course, that was not accepted by the masses. They just wanted to kill the Jews for poisoning the wells. So while the reduced numbers of Jewish casualties could partially be attributed to Jewish customs and kosher laws, it didn't stop the masses from slaughtering and destroying over 200 Jewish communities. Debt eradication was a big part of the massacres of Jews throughout Europe, but it wouldn't be long before the kings of Europe would call upon the Jews for money lending again. So they would kill the Jewish people, they would erase all the debts that the Christians had, and then they would need money again, so they would, you know, it would be a cycle that would go through all those different accusations and massacres where, you know, we need money from the Jewish people, we pay you back some, then they're being taxed, and we don't pay you back everything, then we eradicate all the debts, but then we need more money, so we call upon the Jews again. It was an ongoing cycle. The tension created by the gruesome death of a third of Europe created, it's 25 to 30% of Europe, created more trouble for the Jews. By now, Christians, nobles, kings, and the masses are on edge and ready to snap at the smallest incident involving Jewish people. Take, for instance, the case of a priest in Prague in 1389, about, 40-some years after the end of the Black Plague. A priest was carrying a host, and he was, you know, they're really picky about their hosts. He was carrying a host. I don't know if he was like walking like this or, you know, but he was carrying a host, and some Jewish kids were playing and threw some sand on him. And that led to reprisals and Jewish people being accused of trying to destroy the host. The Jewish people retaliated. At the end, 3,000 Jewish people had died because of that incident. So they are like looking for a reason to get rid of Jewish people. It's crazy. A couple of a map of page 6, a map of the Black Plague and how it progressed. And there were some little pockets. The green, we don't see them green because you have them black and white. But there's a pocket in the middle of south of France and north of Spain. There's a pocket that was spared. And then there's a pocket in northern Italy. And then a big chunk of Poland was also spared. And then a small pocket in the north of France as well. Very strange. But that decimated a large population, a large segment of the population over several, over the time that it was from 47 to 50. On the bottom is just a little painting of the spread of the bubonic plague in Europe. I mean, a lot of art was done to illustrate that, there's a lot of records of how bad it was. So, page 7, the 15th century brought more trouble for the Jewish people, mostly with the continued accusations of ritual murders and host desecration. As a result, we saw more pogroms, confiscations, remissions of debts, and expulsions pretty much all throughout Europe, except for Italy, where Jews had experienced a rather quiet life, protected from all the tribulations experienced elsewhere. Somehow in Italy, and actually I want to give you the reason why Italian Jews had not been used in money lending nearly as much as the rest of Europe. And because they had not been used as money lending, less resentment from the Christians was taking place. So they also had acquired, they had not acquired as much wealth and generated this less resentment from the Christians. They were also protected by Rome, believe it or not, more than many other cities in Europe. Spain, on the other hand, was about to become a place of torture, agony, and death for the Jewish community. The golden age of Spain under Muslim authority, a Muslim ruling, was coming to an end. There's another typo here, coming to an end. And the Inquisition was around the corner. Now, in Italy, Jewish people really had not suffered too much for a period of time, but it was about to change as well. We'll see next week that Italy was the first country of Europe to introduce the ghetto. The ghetto was introduced in Venice in, I think it's the mid-1500, 1578 comes to mind, but I could be wrong. But I'll have the exact date next week. The ghetto was the Italian word for the foundry. It means foundry, metal foundry, and it was a district of Venice that was the foundry that was turned into an enclosed area where all the Jews could live and they could behind walls. That was the first ghetto, and then of course it was developed further in Eastern Europe, in Warsaw and Lodz and different areas. But the Italians came up with the concept, and The word ghetto comes from the Italian word foundry. We'll look at that next week. Spain, three on your outline. Spain and the end of the Golden Age. And then we'll look at the point number four, the Inquisition. Now, the Inquisition with a capital I, there's been a couple of smaller Inquisition before that gave the idea for the big one, and then some smaller ones after the big one, and we'll talk about the big one. When I talk about the Inquisition, I talk about the big one, but they got their idea from events that took place at the time that we're about to cover right now. The Golden Age of the Jewish community of Spain under Islam was attained really during the 11th and 12th centuries under the Almohades. It's a Muslim tribe. Sorry? I know, I'm not even sure I'm saying it right, but that's the way you spell it. And they tried to impose a caliphate. Now, I put a definition of caliphate on the bottom because you need to know about caliphate because it's not going to be in the news on CNN or on Fox or whatever, but it is a modern reality for Islam. It's not something that that was back in those days. Islam is, the one goal of Islam globally is to, they wouldn't use the word impose, but really it is. They want to establish a caliphate. The caliph is the head of the Islamic State globally that is in charge of all Muslims. And I've said it, but I'll say it again, and you need to really understand that, and when people talk to you about Islam, you need to let them know that's what it is. Islam is not just a religion. You know, people talk about the big three, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Well, Judaism is a religion. Christianity is, if you look at Christendom, you know, Catholics and evangelicals, and you know, is a religion, even though us born-again Christians, we don't look at our relationship with the God of the universe as a religion. It's a faith. It's a relationship with the living God. But Islam is looked at by historians and by people that write about religion as the third of the three big religions. But it's more than that. Islam is an ideology. Islam is the umbrella, and under Islam you have a political movement, you have a military movement, you have a religion, you have a banking system under a Sharia law, and those, by the way, there is already Sharia banking in America. You can actually, as a Muslim, go to a Quranic or Islamic bank in America. Most people don't know because we're not, you know, we still have choices here, and there's a, I don't want to get going on Islam here, but there's a number game that is critical. Any number of Muslims in any country, if they're under 2%, they establish themselves, they infiltrate, they establish themselves quietly, and under 2%, you start seeing little things happening here and there, but it's not really the time for them to really push hard. In America, they're under 2%. I think it's 1.6% of the American population. In Europe, in France, and in England, it's, you know, like 8, 9, 10%. And in other countries, it's even more. So there's different levels of involvement from Muslims, depending on how many of them are in a country and how much of a voice they have. They know how much they can push. And they will push accordingly. And we're starting to see things happening in this country. The caliphate is something that Muslims worldwide, it unites Muslims worldwide. They all agree that one day the caliph will be the representative of all of Islam, and it will all be under the law of the Quran or Sharia law. So back then, going back a few centuries, you also need to understand that according to Islam, if you've ever come to a country and conquered it, it belongs to Islam, even if you lose it later. So Muslims believe that everything that has been conquered since Muhammad, even though they might have lost, and they've lost a lot of them, it's theirs to eventually regain, and they will do everything to regain it. That's in the Quran, either in the Quran or in the Hadith. The Hadith are the commentaries on the Quran.
Okay, so the Almohades tried to, that group of Muslims tried to impose a caliphate in North Africa and southern Spain. All of a sudden, not being so friendly to the Jews, not letting them be who they are, and giving them an ultimatum, Islam or death. Spanish Jews moved to the north of Spain, where rulers like Ferdinand the First were more lenient and granted them equal rights with Christians. As a result, the Jewish community continued to flourish in Spain. Intellectual, commercial, and governmental involvement propelled the Jewish community to the forefront of Spanish life. Even under Alfonso VIII, in the mid-1100s to the early 1200s, Jews and Christians fought together against the Muslims. That was unheard of. Now, I don't want you to miss that. Jews had a lot more freedom in Spain at that time. And like I just said, they were, intellectual, commercial, and governmental involvement propelled the Jewish community to the forefront of Spanish life. You have a large segment of the Jewish community who is not allowed for a short period of time to be involved in high places in government, and they become king's physicians and king's lawyers, and they're allowed to perform like everybody else, and they do it well, and it's going to pull a certain number of Jewish people away from religious Jewish life, from synagogue life, and it's going to in a way secularize them to an extent that later on you're going to see an influx of Jewish conversion to Catholic Church, to the Catholic Church, because they have been for several generations allowed to do more in areas where they're always forbidden, and in that it's kind of secularizing. Does that make any sense? They're not staying in their own community as much as they used to protect themselves. They're invited to do more things like everybody else can do, and now they're being secularized, and it's pulling them away from the religious requirements. We're going to see that later when we talk about the Jewish people during the Inquisition. So, Spain at this time was determined to regain its Christian heritage. It's been under Muslim ruling since 711. That was the first conquest of Iberia, another name for Spain. And it's not until 1492 with the Treaty of Granada that it took place. But we're almost there now. We're like in we're getting to that time in history. Many attempts were made by various successive Spanish kings at reconquering Spain. The spirit of 700 years is known as the Reconquista. It's a Spanish word for the reconquering of Spain. Even in the midst of struggles to regain Christian Spain from the Muslims, Jews of Spain were pretty much left alone in comparison to those of France and Germany and England, as we've seen in the previous lessons. Now, what's happening here is that in the northeast area of Aragon, King James the First, not the King James of the King James Bible, tried really hard to bring Jews as well as Muslims to the fold. He was helped by the Dominican monks, Dominicans, who had, for that purpose, learned Hebrew and Arabic to evangelize, so to speak, and bring Jews and Arabs to the fold. So the Dominicans had been appointed to the task. The leader of the group was Raymond of Penaforte, who served as inquisitor. Now, this is not the big Inquisition. This is the little one. This is the practice, not a practice, but this is not the big one. But this is what gave the idea later on to Thomas Torquemada, the Grand Inquisitor for Queen Isabella. One of his most famous Jewish converts, of Raymond of Penaforte, was Pablo Cristiani, who had become a zealous missionary to the Jews, which, very, very often it happens that way. When somebody converts to a different religion or to a different faith, they become more zealous than those who were born and raised in that religion. So he was a Jew who converted to the Catholic Church and became a missionary to the Jews, quote, end quote. Pablo Cristiani was a student of Rabbi Eliezer of Tarascon until he became a Dominican monk and devoted his life to try to convert the Jewish brethren. He was also in favor of burning Talmud and of the Jews wearing the badge of shame that we talked about last week. One of Pablo Cristiani's favorite methods was known as disputation. Now, you all know very well what a disputation is all about. We talked about it earlier. And his most memorable one took place in Barcelona in 1263 against Rabbi Nachmanides, known as Rambam, not Rambam, but Rambam. Christiani was convinced that he could convert Rambam using his own knowledge of the Jewish scriptures and the Talmud. Christiani was a Jew. He was born in a Jewish community. He was raised learning the Jewish scriptures, learning the Talmud, and he thought, from the Talmud, I can convince the Jewish people that they're wrong and that they should convert to Christianity. King James had given the Rabbi Rambam a total freedom of speech, and as they argued, Christiani and King and the Rabbi, they argued on the identity of the Messiah. Rambam won the argument, believe it or not. That's maybe the one of the few cases of real history where a disputation ends up in the favor of the Jewish community. There was a movie made on that event of history, and I think it's called The Disputation. You might want to check it out. I've seen parts of it when I was in the Jewish class at Moody. There was another disputation, I mean many others, but another one that didn't finish so well, the disputation of Tortosa, where this man that we'll talk about him later, Vincent Ferrer, in 1413, was much more devastating to the Jews because there was end up with 3,000 Jewish people converted. 10 out of the 12 rabbis that were coming in the delegation to defend Judaism ended up being converted to the Christianity, I said the Christianity of the time, you know, the Catholic Church. So on the bottom you see a picture of a disputation between Christians and Jews, and by now you should be able to see exactly who's Jewish and who's not on that picture, because they all are wearing the pointy hat. They don't look Jewish, although they do have beards, and the other guys don't have beards. But they definitely have the pointy hats to make sure so that you all know when you look at this that this is the Jewish delegation right there. So Spanish Jews were still able to conduct a reasonably normal life within Spain until the mid to late 1300, after excommunicated King Pedro the Cruel, who actually was a very nice, a good friend of the Jews, believe it or not. He was also known as the Judaized King. He really loved Judaism and the Jewish people. But when he died, his brother Henry replaced him, and things started to severely decline for Spanish Jews. Even though at first King Henry protected the Jews, he ended up reintroducing the badge of shame and making it mandatory for all Jews to wear so they could be recognized. And I'm sure also at the time the hat was also being worn. As Jewish spiritual life had progressively declined in light of the rise of Jewish involvement in Spanish affairs, more Spanish Jews ended up converting to Christianity than ever before. That's what you see here. Jewish people were getting involved in all levels of the government and the royal the kings and in different areas of government. And they walked away, not just walked away by choice, but they slowly walked away from religious life. And a lot of them, over a certain period of time, ended up converting to Catholicism. And that created a large amount of Jewish converts that became known as conversos. Ferdinand, this is the third paragraph here, Ferran Martinez, Archbishop of Seville, fought the Jews on any angle he could, often against crown and clergy. In 1391, he took advantage of a time where there was a passing of the baton between two popes and between two kings, so to speak. So it was a changing of government and clergy, and he initiated riots against the Jews, resulting in 50,000 being either decimated or forcefully converted. Eventually, he was put in prison. But this forced conversion, and you know, a lot of Jewish people would, to keep their life, to not lose their life, they would convert, but they would only convert in appearance. They would not want to, they would not do a full conversion. Well, the result for Spanish Jewry was the loss of quite a few members of the community who would become conversos. And I put a definition of conversos on the bottom of the page. Basically, converts to Christianity. Some of them, not all of them, but some of them would really convert and become more zealous, like Pablo Cristiani, who ended up doing the, you know, all the deputations. One rabbi known as Solomon Levi, rabbi of Burgos, who changed his name to Paul of Santa Maria and later became the bishop of Burgos. He went from the rabbi of Burgos to the bishop of Burgos. Quite a career move here, if you think about it. Was quite serious about converting his people, and he was well respected by Christians. Another one was known by the name of Geronimo de Santa Fe. The one individual who did much in the area of Jewish conversions to Christianity was Vincent Ferrer, who used to travel from synagogue to synagogue and visit the synagogues, and he was credited with 35,000 baptisms of Jews between 1411 and 1412. That's 1 year. As well as 4,000 in 1 month. At one point, he had 4,000 conversions. When he failed to convert the Jews, he was very severe, and it is believed that he came up with the original concept of the ghetto, even though he did not get it started until it was done in Italy about 150 years later, I believe. But he was very successful at converting a lot of Jewish people. But then again, it appeared to be successful. But a lot of the Jewish people were just trying to save their own life and their family, and they would be crypto-Jews. The issue that Christians had with Jews morphed into an issue with conversos, who were now becoming numerous among Christians. Many conversos had not really converted genuinely and had not broken their ties with Judaism. They either secretly continued to practice Judaism as crypto-Jews. Crypto is from the Greek hidden. You know, hidden Jews, they continued being Jews behind closed doors, or openly reverted to Judaism and rejected Christianity altogether. I mean, there are stories of Christians, people put in charge of, like, going on rooftops in Jewish areas where they were supposed to have a lot of converted Jews, and on Friday night for Shabbat, they would go on a rooftop and look down and look at all the chimneys, and those that would have smoke coming out would be those that would actually be cooking and eating, and those who had no smoke coming out would be the Jews that had not really converted because they were keeping the Sabbath laws and they were not cooking. So they would find all kinds of ways to, just like during the Second World War, the Nazis would go to schools all across Europe, France and in Italy and Spain, everywhere, and they would ask for the boys to drop their trousers. Circumcision was not the norm in Europe. It still is not, like in America. So if a boy was circumcised, he was Jewish. The girls, they couldn't tell. But for the boys, they would go into school, and then a couple of Nazi officers would come and ask for all the boys to drop their trousers, and they would just go, okay, come with us. So that was the way, you know. So they, anti-Semitic people over the centuries always found ways to expose who was Jewish and who was not, based on what they knew should happen or didn't happen. So the crypto Jews became a problem. As a matter of fact, these as they called them, nuevo conversos, the new converts, became a disgrace to the Christians, who quickly started to hate them even more than they hated unconverted Jews. They became known as the Moranos, the swine, the pigs. That's what you've heard, Moranos, you know, books, stories about the Moranos of Spain, Jews who falsely converted and continued to practice Judaism behind closed doors. The Moranos' double standard created a tidal wave of hatred from the pulpits of Spain, and anti-Maronism, you know, against the Moranos, was added to anti-Semitism. They started to feed upon one another with the idea that they both came from mala sangre, or bad blood, basically the result of hereditary Jewishness. The Jewish people, for the first time now, Judaism was no longer a theological problem. Convert or we kill you, but if you convert, you can live with us, you can be in our community. Now it became an ethnic problem. Because even those who converted were still from Jewish descent. It was in the blood, and if it's in the blood, it became an ethnic problem. For the first time now, the Judaism was no longer a theological problem, but it became an ethnic problem. And of course, that will be picked up at a much greater degree during the Holocaust, but this is a big shift here in just at the dawn of the Inquisition. So brutal attacks against the Muranos of Spain became more and more common. Something had to be done to deal with the problem. Numerous demands from Franciscans and Dominicans came for the reintroduction of the Inquisition. They had done Inquisition with a small I prior. Now it's time for the Inquisition with a big I. And we have just enough time to cover this last few pages on the Inquisition. 1479, King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain had finally succeeded in uniting the two kingdoms of Castile and Aragon. And they're actually getting excited. They go like, you know what, maybe we can also reunite Spain under the Christian banner as well. We're almost at the point where we have expelled all the Muslims back to wherever they are, and Spain is back under Christian rule. So it's given them hope for a unified Christian Spain as well. Queen Isabella, she has a personal confessor, personal priest, so to speak, like, you know, the people have personal physician and lawyers. Well, she had her own confessor, and it was none other than Thomas Torquemada, who would later become the Grand Inquisitor, the mastermind behind the Inquisition. And he immediately pushed for the reestablishment of the Inquisition. But this time he wanted to be not under Christian ruling, but under secular control. It would give probably more power to do what he wanted to do. To rid Spain of the Muranos, crypto-Jews, once and for all. After some resistance, the Inquisition was reintroduced with two Dominicans in charge in 1480. The first auto da fé in Portuguese and in Spanish means act of faith, when they would just basically try to convert Jews or kill them, was held within a year under the Inquisition, resulting in six Jews burned at the stake. That was just the very beginning of it. Auto da fés were the ritual of public penance of condemned heretics and apostates. In this case, Muranos, of course, and it took place after their punishment were decided. They were usually followed by an imprisonment or an execution by the civil authorities. There's a picture of Saint Dominic presiding over an auto da fé in Avila, 1475. You see the Jews being ready to be executed here. So it was just a small beginning that would lead to a gigantic operation taking the life of thousands of Muranos across all of Spain. It started with the Muranos, it continued with all Jews. Kind of like during the Second World War, when my grandfather was taken by the Gestapo, they were just looking for illegal Jews in France. He did not have legal papers. He came from Poland and he was working in France, married my grandmother, but he didn't have his legal papers. So they first came with the excuse of taking the illegals, and then they just came to take anybody. But it started small here during the Inquisition. It picked up momentum, taking the life of thousands of Muranos across all of Spain. If death was not always the final outcome, imprisonment, public humiliation, and or confiscation of property would almost always take place. In 1483, Torquemada was appointed Inquisitor General, or Grand Inquisitor. For years to come, Muranos and all of Spanish Jews eventually lived in a constant state of terror. The procedure was always the same. Investigation, they would go from town to town, asking questions, getting information, gathering information. That was the first step in investigation. Then a trial, always favoring the prosecution, being the church, of course. Then after the trial came the torture. To try to, you know, you're guilty, but we're going to give you a chance to change. Torture, they were usually people would be hung by wrists with weights on their ankles. And I'm not talking about, you know, the kind of weights that you put when you go walking in the morning, okay? We're talking about weights that basically would hang the people, and within hours, they would end up being dismembered. Okay. Now, a strange law, I read on it a couple of days ago, it's so strange, I didn't even want to put it in the notes, but a strange law required that all torture would only be done once. You could only torture the apostates and the Muranos and the Jews once. After that, you'd be done. But It was okay to take breaks for the torturer. So they would torture somebody and come back the next day and torture them again and come back the next day and torture them again. It was considered, you know, a session with a break. That doesn't make any sense. But, you know, a lot of people died after their trial. A lot of people died through the torture. So the punishment of prison, confiscation of property, or death, very often, they didn't even go through that because they died during the torture. But all in all, the Inquisition failed at completely eradicating the Muranos. There were still Jewish people that had converted to Christianity but were not really meaning it. They were not, you know, a lot of them were still surviving. And it turned, the Inquisition decided to turn its attention on all Jews of Spain, like I just finished telling you. So Torquemada noticed the bond. There was a bond between Orthodox Jews and Muranos. And when he realized he could not control it through the Inquisitional procedures, he finally went, okay, you know what? We tried to eliminate all the Muranos and we were somewhat successful. We tried to eliminate all the Jews that we could find. We were somewhat successful, but there's still too many and we can't get them. So then he went to Queen and the King, Ferdinand and Isabella, and he asked for the complete expulsion of all Jews of Spain. It was refused originally, but he insisted. And in 1490, a group of Muranos, the timing was really convenient for him. In 1490, 2 years before the actual expulsion of the Jews, a group of Muranos was accused of plotting for the destruction of Christianity through host desecration, again, and the crucifixion of a boy. And that event catapulted Torquemada in the forefront of the king and the queen's palace, and he said, "See, I'm telling you, this is bad. They're at it again. We got to put a stop to it." At that time, he asked for what also happened is that Spain had just finished retaking Granada, the last outpost, the last stronghold that was still controlled by the Muslims, and in 1492 they signed the Treaty of Granada, and Spain was back to completely Spanish under the king and the queen, and trying to, you know, bring Christianity back to Spain. So there was no more Muslim by 1492. So at that time, Torquemada, because of the events that took place at that time, he was successful. He got what he wanted, and the decree was issued in 1492. For all Jews to leave Spain within 6 months. It was decreed in January. And for all Jews within 6 months, they were all had to leave. The chief rabbi of Spain and Spain tax collector, Abraham Senor, is said to have offered a large sum to King Ferdinand, who was known for his, he was very greedy and he loved money and gifts. And so he offered a lot of money. And Torquemada came to his palace with a cross. And he came to the king and he said, "Judas Iscariot sold Messiah for 30 pieces of silver. Will your highness sell him for 300,000 gold coins? Here he is, take him and sell him." So he tried to intimidate the king by telling him that you're just like Judas Iscariot, you're going to sell Jesus again for money. And the king eventually flexed and he said, "Okay, fine, I'll help. I hold fast to my decree, and I'm not going to change it." And the result was 300,000 Jewish people had to leave within 6 months. A lot of them went to Italy, Turkey, and Portugal. Unfortunately, Portugal was the host country of another smaller Inquisition that took the life of many Jewish people and the new community of Muranos that had arrived there. Some Jewish people also ended up going on the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria with Christopher Columbus. How many, I don't know, because we're not, 300,000 Jews, those ships did not hold a tremendous amount of people. So we don't know exactly how many, but it is believed that some Jewish people came to the Americas with Christopher Columbus. And somebody told me in the earlier class today that somebody read that it's a Jewish person who first saw the land and called for land when they arrived in America. I don't know if I think it's probably true because they arrived, where New York is, And then the Jewish guy was looking, and he also, when he smelled the pastrami sandwiches, that we arrived. But that's, you know, I can't prove that, okay? I can't prove that. By the end of the 15th century, the Jew has become an undesirable agent of Satan. The terms Jewish and diabolical, or evil, were now synonymous. The Jews, of course, the symbol of the cross, so dear to Christians. You think about the Crusades and the Inquisition and in all those Christian events that have the cross everywhere. The symbol of the cross, so dear to Christians, has become such an offense and became known as a symbol of disaster. This is why today, you know, Jewish people, when they see a cross or a church or anything that's to do with Christianity, it takes them back to all this that most people, you know, don't know about the study of the Inquisition, you know, the Crusades, and but there's never the emphasis that we're putting in this class on what happened to the Jewish people. Now, you put yourself in the shoes of a Jewish person, and that Jewish person hears from one of us, you need to believe that Jesus is the Messiah. They're going to go like, you're crazy. Let me tell you about the history of my people, and you tell me if I should, and then I tell you about all this. So all this is a constant reminder for believers like us that the church continually carries baggage. We have baggage that we have with us that we cannot get rid of. We have to be aware of it, we have to know what happened, and we have to be equipped to talk to our Jewish friends, but we have that baggage, it's never going to go away. It's just part of history. So, medieval anti-Semitism left a mark that the 21st century is still trying to erase. This is the end of the Middle Ages. Next week, we'll start into a new period.